Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Aaron Brown, sitting in today for Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is freedom under the law, or why democracy does not work and how freedom and prosperity flourish without the violence of government. I first want to welcome our very special guest, Dr. David Gordon. Hello, Dr. Gordon.
Oh, hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm excellent. Glad to be with you. Dr. Gordon is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He earned his PhD in intellectual history at UCLA. He is the editor of the Mises Review, a contributor to several economics and philosophy journals, including the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and has authored several great books, including Resurrecting Marx and The Philosophical Origins of Austrian Economics. There's a paper written by the famous Austrian economist and Nobel laureate F.A. Hayek called The Decline of the Rule of Law, and in it Hayek talks about how political wisdom is handed down from generation to generation. And a great point he made was that oftentimes a wonderful idea is embodied in a simple phrase like rule of law. We hear rule of law, everyone's familiar with the term. But over the years, the origins and the ideas behind the idea are lost. So the goal of this interview is to apply this idea to the term rule of law that we hear so often and show our listeners where that idea actually came from, the source of this idea of freedom under law or rule of law, and why real rule of law should matter to them. This is a very important show, and this is one I hope our listeners go back to listen to several times over, since not many understand the knowledge contained in this interview. So Dr. Gordon, Hayek wrote in this article that the phrase rule of law came from a Greek word called isonomia. And for those of you listening, that is spelled I-S-O-N-O-M-I-A. So I'm just going to let you go at it. David, can you tell us the story of isonomia? What does isonomia mean, and where did it come from?
Oh, yes. Well, I should say I'm glad that you start off with mentioning Friedrich Hayek, because he was one of my teachers. I was in his class for philosophy of social science, and he was visiting at UCLA in 1969. I took that class. He was an easy grader. But what Hayek meant, isonomia, is sort of the notion of you first have to get the Greek word nomos, meaning law, and this is isonomia, meaning sort of self-rule or self-law. So it would be the notion of giving the law to yourself. And what Hayek had principally in mind, something like this, suppose you're planning your action, like you're going to do various things during the day, you have your regular activities. It's very important for you to know that force won't be used against you unless you do certain things. Say, you know, unless you start beating up people or robbing them, the government isn't going to use force against you. So Hayek thought it was very important that we, in planning our activities, that we have we know in advance when force might be used. We'll have there are fixed rules that tell us unless you do such and such, force won't be used against you. And by having fixed rules, this will enable us to plan our activities. Now, Hayek extended that, and he thought that all government regulations, all laws, should be of this general character. There shouldn't be laws singling out particular people or particular groups of people. That all the laws would have this very general character, so then people would be able to plan their activities and rational action could take place. So that's basically what he meant by rule of law.
Okay, I see. And we're coming close to the end of this first segment. We will be back with Dr. David Gordon. We are talking about freedom under the law. We will be back on Radio Free Market. Stay with us. Welcome back to RadioFreeMarket.com. We are talking to David Gordon about freedom under the law. So, David, we just discussed where isonomia came from, and it means, the etymology of the word means self-rule. So I wanted to ask you, David, we're all taught in America that America is a democracy and that democracy is the greatest of all political systems. Was America founded as a democracy?
No, it actually wasn't. If you look at the founding fathers, they were very critical of democracy. They thought of democracy as something like mob rule. And I think we can see what they had in mind when we say, well, of course, everybody believes in democracy because what would be the alternative? Wouldn't be some kind of dictatorship. But you see, this is really a false antithesis. It's not a correct. Those are sort of like asking you to choose between two bads. Now, democracy is a system in which the majority decides what the law will be or what the government should do, either directly or by representative. But this is not necessarily in accord with the rule of law in the way we just explained it, because suppose you can have in a democracy, you could have all sorts of arbitrary acts. You could say have laws suppressing minorities as long as the majority voted for them. So the idea of a rule of law, by contrast, is that each person has a sphere of rights that tell him what he can do and that the government would not interfere with him unless he uses force to violate other people's rights. So see, even if the majority of people wanted to interfere with people, that would be inconsistent with the rule of law. So the rule of law and democracy are two very different things, and the founding fathers were very clear that they wanted government, laws, that they, this is the whole point of the Bill of Rights, that there are restrictions on what Congress can do. That it isn't, say, we say the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That means that Congress can't make such a law. It's not, even if the majority in Congress, the majority of people want such a law, they can't do it. So that's not strict. We don't have a strict democracy in this country, and we weren't intended to.
Mm-hmm. And on that point, the founders, David just said, the founders of America were well aware of what democracy really meant, and that's why they were critical of it. And I found a couple quotes from the founders, this one from Thomas Jefferson, and it's very illuminating. Listen to what Jefferson says about democracy, just to David's point. He said, quote, "A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49%. And John Adams said this about democracy. He said, "Democracy, while it lasts, is more bloody than either aristocracy or monarchy. Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There is never a democracy that did not commit suicide." I mean, that's a pretty intense quote. So David, if the American people knew and understood these kinds of quotes from the founders, do you think there would be a different attitude towards the very idea of democracy?
Yes, I think it's because it's just a term that's come into common use, and people just say, especially during World War II and World War I, they would contrast the democracies with dictatorships and say, well, we're fighting the Nazi dictatorship and we're a democracy, but that wasn't the actual way the founding fathers intended things. I was very interested in your quotation, especially from Jefferson, that was so much in agreement with what I was saying. Jefferson must have been listening in to our broadcast.
That's of course who he credits the future David Gordon for his ideological tenet.
Yes, why not backwards causation?
So in prepping for this show, Michael McKay, he suggests I explore the idea that instead of rule of law, today in America we have kind of rule by our temporary ruler of the day, whoever the masses vote in. How does democracy lead to this type of situation?
Well, I think Michael makes a very good point there, because in a democracy, it's whatever law, whatever rule gets the approval of the majority will be the law, and that can change. Say you can always have shifting majorities. Say we see, for example, today Obama was elected by a substantial number of people, but now it appears a lot of people are very critical of him. So you can have majorities can change from time to time, but the notion of a rule of law, the law really remains stable. That doesn't mean there can never be any new laws, but if you have a rule of law, there have to be stable general regulations in place so people can plan their activities, so you don't have this kind of shift that you do in democracy, in a pure democracy where it's just dependent on the popular will and emotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even write this down, but I was just thinking, you know, it's very inconsistent, the government in general, because we're talking about isonomia, kind of this consistent general body of rules. But then in our present system, the masses will, or the 51%, the majority will vote in a certain type of legislation. But then even if the other 49%, the next time they get into office, they never repeal the last thing that the opposition, you know, the majority of the last regime, they'll never repeal those legislation. They're just impose their own. So all of a sudden we have this huge, you know, massive body of legislation, but no regime ever really repeals the legislation of the last.
Yes, that is an interesting point. You find in general a trend toward an increase in government control of our lives and government control of the economy. Even when you find people, say as Reagan did, say, well, we want to cut back on government, it doesn't really do that. It's maybe the increase isn't as much as it would have been with some others, but it's still an increase. So we do have a general trend toward more government control, whereas the notion of rule of law is, aside from these fixed general regulations, people should be free to conduct their activities as they want. And the way Hayek took it was that freedom consists of having this, or knowing that we're just limited by these general regulations. There are various objections that one could make to that, but I think he has there's certainly a great deal in what he says that we want there to be some very stable set of regulations rather than be subject to the arbitrary will of other people, even if this arbitrary will is supported by a temporary majority.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked for now about 9 minutes about democracy. Why does this matter? Why should our listeners care? You know, democracy seems to be working, you know, just fine, you know, fine and dandy. Why should our listeners even care? Why should they be concerned that America has become a democracy?
Well, I think the thing to understand is that democracy isn't working that well. As we see, the economy is rather collapsed. We're involved in wars in Afghanistan. We're still elsewhere. You know, we're sort of in a very bad state of affairs just because we're subject to arbitrary rule. Like if we had a free market economy under the rule of law, then we wouldn't be in the financial economic mess we are now. We wouldn't have had such a collapse as we did in 2008. We wouldn't be involved in all sorts of foreign wars that whether they have any relation to American national interest or not. So democracy doesn't work very well. One thing, in particularly in foreign policy, there's a very influential theory now that says democracies don't go to war with each other. So this notion is just a recipe for more wars, because it the consequence people draw from that theory is we have to replace all sorts of non-democratic regimes with democracies, and this is just a recipe for perpetual war.
Yeah, it seems as if, you know, if the American government takes upon itself the right to go anywhere and spread democracy, that, yeah, we shouldn't really be surprised when, you know, if we go into Iran or if we go into, you know, this or that place. But that's beside the point. For our listeners who are still in there, we have about a minute and a half left, so you'll have about a minute to respond to this. For our listeners who are in their intellectual discovery or still don't really realize how dangerous democracy is, I'd just like to have you comment on this quote, since you're the Marx expert. And this is what Marx said about democracy. Marx said, "Democracy is the road to socialism." And this should be shocking to everyone listening. I mean, this is Karl Marx saying this. Karl Marx was of the opinion that democracy paves the way for socialism. And, of course, he didn't think that was such a bad thing. So just to bring up an important statistic that has been brought up in other shows, in the 20th century, socialist regimes were responsible for 94 million deaths. So for our listeners, that is why you should care that America has become a democracy. So can you comment on this quote, David? You have about 45 seconds.
Well, I think what Marx had in mind there was that if you have a democracy, that subjects property to the will of the majority, and he hoped that through what he considered called bourgeois democracy, this would lead to a revolution. Then you'd have proletarian democracy, where the proletariat would act as be in charge.
David, after the break, I want you to comment on that again. I'm sorry, we're coming close to the end of this segment. Please stay with us on Radio Free Market. We'll be back with Dr. David Gordon on the rule of law. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market. And, David, I want to let you finish that thought on that quote from Karl Marx when he said, "Democracy is the road to socialism." So go ahead.
What Marx tended to do, he wrote in various accounts when he was dealing with certain revolutions at the time, like he wrote Hamlet's Civil Wars in France, and he wrote on the Third Commune. In European politics, especially in France and Germany in the 19th century, there were struggles between different political groups. You had when Marx thought that these political groups represented particular class interests, and the democratic parties usually represented the what he called the bourgeoisie, where the middle class or lower middle class parties, and he supported those as against the aristocracy. He thought that by putting them in, it would be easier to make a transition to socialism. So he thought once there was a proletarian revolution of the workers, then there would be a new kind of democracy in which the proletariat would assume dictatorial powers and then suppress all the other classes. So that would be the sense in which he thought democracy was the road to socialism. I'd have to see the context of the quote to know exactly what he had in mind, but that in general was his view.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So for our listeners, that's what we just heard, was that Karl Marx saw democracy in his kind of brand of supporting democratic, the kind of bourgeoisie class interest, as a way to fuel the proletariat revolution, and that they would take over, that they would foment a revolution and take over the country.
Yes, that's right. I mean, say if you look, say the history of 20th century politics, say the American communists would tend to support very left-wing measures that would be considered more democratic, because they thought that would be a means of helping them achieve their revolutionary goals.
Mm-hmm. So our goal today is to integrate the concept of ethics, you know, norms of fairness and cooperation with the law. And I think most reasonable people would agree that equality under the law or rule of law is a must for a free and open society. It means the same rules apply to everyone. So first we have to have a few ground rules, and I just put two and only two, since I only think two rules are really needed. for a free society, and that's universal respect for other people's property and do what you say you will do. In other words, keep your promises. So I want to read a very profound quote from Aristotle about private property rights. He said, "That which is common to the greatest number has the least care bestowed upon it. Everyone thinks chiefly of his own, hardly at all of the common interest, and only when he is himself concerned as an individual." And he also said, "Property should be as a general rule private, for when everyone has a distinct interest, men will not complain of one another, and they will make more progress because everyone will be attending to his own business." So, David, why is private property so important to a free society?
Well, I think Aristotle given a very good case there that when he was writing that, you see, he was criticizing Plato, who in the Republic proposed a system in which the guardian class would have all property in common, and they would also raise their children in common. And Aristotle's point is, well, we don't care very much for things that aren't directly under our control. Say, we would find, say, people will take, say, much better care of their own yard than they will of the public street because their yard belongs to them. So we can make a very good case. It's in our self-interest to have property. And then it's also important that property is an individual right, that if we acquire, say, land or other resources that no one else has used, it's within our rights to do so, and other people don't have the right to then take it away from us. So even if, say, the government said, well, look, there are all these very poor people or unfortunate people, we want to take away your money and give it to them, we think this is a good use of the money. Even if it is a good use of the money, it's up to us to decide whether we want to spend it in that way. It's our right to own our own income and property.
And on that, that's a good segue into our next point. We only have about a minute left, but I'm going to bring this up anyway and let you go as far as you can in the next minute. But I'd just like to bring out a few examples just to illustrate this point in the context of property rights, which we just talked about. This point that equality under the law is not actually present in America today. At first, I think it's necessary to simply define, for example, what a bailout actually is. I think a lot of times people, it's not that people don't have a common sense of decency and fairness. It's just that a lot of times they're confused. And so I want you to please just define what a bailout actually entails. And you have about 20 seconds.
Oh, well, a bailout would be saying that it's because the government thinks it's very dangerous for the economy if certain firms fail, it's going to take money away from the rest of us and give it to these failing firms. It doesn't sound like a very good idea, and it violates our rights. What if we don't want to help out these firms?
Mm-hmm. And we're going to come back to that after the break. We are here on Radio Free Market with Dr. David Gordon talking about freedom under the law. Please stay with us. Hello, America. We are back at Radio Free Market. David, so I just asked you to define a bailout, and you defined it as basically the government, because they have a sense that the economy is in danger, that they're going to take money from the tax base, from everyone who pays taxes, and give it to a company that has failed. That's why it's called a bailout. So now that we've defined what a bailout actually is, because I don't think a lot of people know that the bailout money, it's not, they don't get it from some vault. They just tax us and then they take it, or sometimes they do it through inflation, just by money printing. So could you briefly comment on this idea of equality under the law and ethics, you know, norms of fairness in the context of the recent multi-trillion dollar bailouts of the banks and General Motors, among other companies?
Yes, well, I think we can see very clearly that this bailout violates the notion of equality under the law, because let's imagine say you have a business, say you have a small restaurant, and it isn't doing very well, you're losing money on it, you can't go to the government and say, look, this is going to have a bad effect on my neighborhood. If my business fails, all my spending will go down, then this will have bad results for the people who, that I would have been spending money on. So you should give me money to help me out. We can't do this, but these banks that get the money will get enormous sums of money just because the government thinks there's going to be some big danger if they fail. Now, I think we can criticize this on two grounds. First, it hasn't been shown at all that if businesses fail, this is going to drag the whole economy down with them. We find businesses, even very large businesses, fail all the time. And what we need is, Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek point out, in a depression, Murray Rothbard was very much emphasizes, a depression represents the correction phase of the business cycle. In a boom, there's been malinvestment. There have been investments in projects that can't be supported, and these need to be liquidated. So the bailout actually interferes with economic recovery. And then the second point is, even if the government were correct these businesses needed to be helped, that would still be a matter for the owners of the money to decide, not for Congress to decide. The government doesn't have the right to say, well, because we think that it's very important that a particular business not fail, therefore you can take your resources away from your money away from you to help that business. So basically, there are two points that the particular arguments they give are unsound, and they wouldn't have the right to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a moment. You know, Dr. Gordon, if the banks weren't bailed out, there would have been chaos. Hundreds of thousands of Americans would have lost their deposits. Thousands of workers would have been unemployed from General Motors. And as Tom Woods says, the earth would have broken free from its axis and gone spinning towards the sun. You know, would it have been more ethical to simply let these big companies fail, even if it would have meant terrible economic instability?
Well, you see, that's assuming that there would be such instability. But, you know, to say that is to fall into this, Frédéric Bastiat, the great 19th century French economist, called the broken window fallacy, is say, if you take money away from certain people to help these businesses, that'll certainly help those businesses. The banks then won't fail. But then these other people, the ones you've taken the money away from, then don't have the money to spend they otherwise would have. So it's true that if a business fails, various people will be out of work, will have to adjust. But the way to solve that, the best way to handle that, is simply to allow the market to work so that people will be able to adjust as fast as possible. If you take away money from people, then you're just interfering with the adjustment process. So you're hurting those you take the money away from. What about them? Why should we just consider the ones who were helped and say, look, these people would be in bad, have various bad effects if they're not helped? What about the ones you take it away from?
Mm-hmm. And to that point, you know, the more I look at the ethical issues, the philosophical issues, you know, the moral issues, I find out more and more that economics plays a huge part in all of them. And I think most people would agree that, you know, using violence against people you don't like is incompatible with freedom and the rule of law. But the public education system, and I think the media, would have us believe that, for example, taxes on goods imported from China, that is good for America, or that the great men who run the government should be allowed to in my home state, you know, in California, for instance, the government should be allowed to hire men with machine guns to invade marijuana shops for the common good. So how are these examples indicative of how far America has strayed from the ideal of freedom under the law?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the examples you mentioned, these are interfering with voluntary transactions among people who aren't violating the rights of others. So to take your first example, suppose somebody wants to purchase something from China because he thinks that he can get the product is either better than what he can get in the U.S. or he can buy the similar project for less money. Why should the fact, if it is one, that this an American business would be better off if the person bought from that business, why should that justify the government stopping the consumer from buying from China? I think there's a tendency, and this I see in a lot of criticisms of free trade, that people will say, well, what's good for the economy, as if the economy were some separate individual. And we say, well, this will hurt the American national economy, and what we have to do rather is consider just the particular individuals involved. There's no separate economy apart from the individuals who are involved in particular transactions. So what we have in the case of tariffs or other interferences with trade is interfering with the freedom of individuals in order to benefit other persons. So this is certainly a violation of equality under the law, rule of law. It's saying that particular people can be harmed in order to benefit other particular people, which is the exact contrary of what Hayek had in mind by the rule of law, where you have general regulation. Similarly, in your second example with the invading of marijuana growers, if people choose to use that drug, why does anyone else have the right to stop them just because they think it's wrong or they think that people shouldn't use it? It's up to them. They're not, the users of that aren't violating anyone else's rights. They're not compelling other people to use that drug. They just want to engage in a peaceful form of activity.
I've had some interesting conversations with some of my libertarian friends lately, just about kind of how an odd phenomenon it is that the left gets this reputation for being kind of hippie, groovy, you know, the out there wild ones, when really it's libertarians that are kind of the most you know, live and let live, you know, hippie, groovy. We don't really care. I can't speak for the whole group. I don't really care as a libertarian. I don't really care if you want to go and, you know, sniff glue all day. I mean, it's really not up to me as long as you're not harming me or my property. So I just thought that was, it's an interesting phenomenon that the left kind of gets this reputation for being the kind of hippie, groovy, live and let live ones. But anyway, that's beside the point. For our listeners, you can bring that up with a leftist friend, that we're really the hippie, groovy ones. So David, I've had some conversations recently about just how odd it is that, you know, the freedom under the law that we're talking about, and I think this is the most important question out of the whole interview, the freedom under law that we're talking about right now, we really learned it when we were in kindergarten. I mean, when we are kids, what are we taught? Aggressive violence is wrong and bad. Taking other people's things without their permission is not acceptable behavior. We learn that telling the truth is moral and it's good, and that everyone should be treated the same. No one should be getting preferential treatment. But when we grow up, we become accustomed to seeing adults and even our own government, who I think most people agree is supposed to be kind of the fairest institution in the land. We see adults and the government killing people, lying their faces off, stealing other people's things, even in times of great hardship, and allowing certain types of people to get away with things that most cannot, a la, you know, bailouts and things like that. So can you comment on this phenomenon? I just want to get your opinion.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think you raise a point here that is actually very important when I was becoming acquainted with libertarian and classical liberal ideas back in my junior high days. I read the great pamphlet that I want to recommend to all the listeners by Frederick Bastiat, who I mentioned before, called The Law. And the fundamental point he makes there is very similar to what you were mentioning in your comment, that people have the idea, what he considered the wrong idea, that the government has certain rights or follow certain moral rules that are different, should follow certain moral rules that are different from the rights of individuals. And he said, no, this isn't true. Just by getting together in a group, you don't acquire new moral. So it's the same morality that applies to individuals in the government. So if, just as we say, it's wrong for individuals to steal or to use force on others who haven't used force on them first, it's wrong for the government to do so also. So the fundamental point is the government doesn't acquire rights that individuals don't have. And if we realize this very simple point, I think we'd be a lot better off. And it would require getting rid of nearly everything the government does.
That sounds good to me.
Yes, yes, exactly.
It's funny. So the next question I wanted to ask you is, I think every person would agree, just like to your point that you just said, no man has, or group of men, has the right to exercise authority over another man. It's just, that's just not right. Many hundreds of years ago, you know, some kings claimed divine right, that they were chosen by God to be kings, and now we know that is just illegitimate. Emperors in Asia, they claimed the mandate of heaven, that, you know, again, they were chosen by God. And I think the world is more civilized now, and these ideas are correctly seen as illegitimate and wrong. So since no man or group of men has the right to rule over another man or group of men, and since this is actually the very nature of modern-day government, in that sense, is a coercive government illegitimate?
Yes, I think it is. If you carry the idea out to its full logical point, then I think one would be inclined to agree with Murray Rothbard, who was my great friend for many years, the person I've learned the most about on political and economic matters from anyone else, that he thought what we take to be even the legitimate functions of government, like defense and justice, could be handled by private market agencies, such as insurance companies or protection agencies. So he thought, why do we have to have a coercive government at all? Why shouldn't people make the arrangements for defense and justice that they voluntarily want to? Why do we have to have it forced on them if they don't want these?
Mm-hmm. You know, is it possible to have a peaceful society that operates within the rule of law, but also with the maximum amount of freedom for the individual without any person or group being given the monopoly of aggressive violence? And what principles must be widely shared to achieve that?
Well, I think it is possible because we see the market working very well, much better than government-controlled economy. So why would these other defense or justice be anything different? And the whole thing fundamentally depends, I think, on people coming to accept that only peaceful measures of resolution are acceptable, that we can't violate other people's rights, even if they're doing so is in pursuit of certain goals that we think are important. Say people realize, well, we can't take other people's property just because we think we want to help out certain firms or industries, then I think we'd have a chance of establishing a libertarian society. I think we'd be a lot better off, and we'd also be acting in accord with ethical requirements.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was watching a Ron Paul video on YouTube the other day, and about a minute ago you said something, and I forgot to comment on it, but I'm coming back to it now. It was something about this idea that the government kind of takes upon itself to legislate morality. And that was kind of the first time I really thought critically about that, was when Ron Paul brought this up in a speech he gave, that you can't legislate morality. There would be no, it would be completely arbitrary, because again, it would be a completely democratic mob rule decision where whoever the temporary majority is at the time would come in and give their morality, and they would write that law, and then the next regime would come in and give their, legislate their particular brand of morality. So can you comment on that, how it's impossible to legislate morality and have a free society?
Oh yes. Well, there are two points there. One that I think brought out in what you said, Ron Paul said, morality is not something that is dependent on majority rule. There's if we think that people have certain property rights, that isn't something that's subject to legislation. So the fact that, so if you have people trying to legislate morality, would just be, they would be legislating their particular views on what people should do, and there would be no reason to think that these would be in accord with what is the correct morality. Then you might object to that. Well, what if they happen to pick out what turns out to be the correct moral views? Why couldn't they legislate that? Then this point there would be, in order to...
David, we're coming close to the end of this segment. I'm so sorry to cut you off. That's such a good point. But we will come back to that at the end of this break. We are on Radio Free Market with Dr. David Gordon. Please stay with us. Hello, America, and welcome back to Radio Free Market. And David, you were discussing a point before I cut you off. I'll let you go at it.
Oh, well, the point was this, and I think it's a fundamental one, is if we're supposed to be acting morally, this is what we're doing there, is we have to be acting freely. I mean, if someone, suppose you think that, say, it's morally wrong to use heroin. So if somebody's standing over you and said, well, I'm going to shoot you if you use heroin, then if you decide not to use it, you're not really acting morally. You're just saying, well, I'm going to bow to this person's superior force. So in order to act morally, we have to be free to act. And if the government legislates morality, this is really contradictory, because it's trying to get us to act morally in a way that can't achieve that end, since it's forcing us to be moral, so it's taking away our freedom.
That's a very interesting point. David, in my kind of learning process, one of the hardest things for me to kind of internalize or even to investigate, and I think for many people this is true, was to imagine freedom under the law without a coercive government, because of two things. These are the biggies. Courts. How can you have courts and dispute resolution without government? And security, defense. Is it possible to have courts and security organized on the free market without the heavy hand of government?
Oh, well, I think there the thing to realize, there was a medieval maxim that used by medieval logicians, said what is actual is possible. If something is actually taking place, then it's possible to have that. And we have had all sorts of private courts. In fact, courts developed really as agencies to settle disputes. And Bruno Leone has a very good book called Freedom and the Law, where he discusses how law can arise without legislation, just by having courts decide things, and then this becomes precedents get established, and we can build up a body of law without having it formally legislated. This was true both of English common law and Roman law, which Roman law developed in large part through private opinions by people who were recognized as authorities. They would simply write out their opinions, and then these would become accepted by other Roman lawyers.
Huh. I did not know that. So, and you gave one book. What, for our listeners, what is a good book or two on this subject of private courts and private security defense?
Well, one I like very much was by the person I mentioned who influenced me more than anyone else, Murray Rothbard. This is called Power and Market. It's the second part of Man, Economy, and State. You can get this gigantic volume from the Mises Institute. If you don't want to buy it, you can actually get it online, called Man, Economy, and State with Power and Market. So if you look at the Power and Market, you can see this in operation. And I think Bruce Benson has a book on this subject. I have to, something like on private sort of decision making without the government. I'd have to look up the exact title of that, but if you just go to Bruce Benson, you can get that. That's one of the best books on that subject.
Okay. And we have about 1 minute left, and I just wanted to, in this last minute, Michael sent me an email informing me of your upcoming class on the epistemology of Ludwig von Mises. When does this course begin, and you know, what's your goal, just very briefly?
Well, the course begins April 7th. It's 5 lectures. And what I had in mind is many people, when they read Mises, particularly Human Action, they'll be stumped by about the first 100 pages because they find it very difficult. They wonder, what is all this philosophical stuff? What I'm going to try to do is explain in easy-to-understand
language. David, I'm sorry to cut you off. I made this last segment too short, but if you want to check out David's course, it is on mises.org. Thank you to David Gordon for being with us today. This is Aaron Brown of Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. And wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.